With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom, reach new audiences, and bring important information to the public free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Simply go to tntradio.live. This is Jesse Zurawell and Perspective on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome to Perspective. I'm Jesse Zurawell, your host for the hour. Back with me today is Ed Curtin. Ed is a writer and sociologist whose work can be found at edwardcurtin.com. He's also published frequently at offguardian.org. And you should very much check out his recent collection of lyrical and critical essays, Seeking Truth in a Country of Lies. It's always a pleasure to speak with Ed. I never know where our conversations are going to take us, and I expect today to be no different. Ed, how are you?
I'm good, Jesse. Good afternoon. It's good to be here.
Good afternoon to you.
To see where we're traveling today.
Yes. So in your recent essay, which you published just over a week ago on the anniversary or a day before the anniversary of Armistice Day, among other titles, it's given November 11th, this essay you published, Who Knew We're Here Because We're Here Because We're Here Because We're Here, you write, so many people feel lost in a world gone mad, a nowhere land, far further from somewhere. How is the world gone mad treating you?
Well, the title, as I said in that opening, I believe, comes from a song that mostly British soldiers sang when they were in the trenches during World War I. And those soldiers had no idea why they were there, and they sang this ironic, mocking song, We're here because we're here because we're here because we're here. Not knowing, of course, why the hell they were there, and they were in hell. It's very reminiscent also of soldiers in any war zone, of Vietnam, Iraq, you name it, not knowing why they're fighting the fight that they're in. However, so they felt, these soldiers felt very lost, and I believe that's true today for most people as they contemplate the world that they're living in. They're here, we're here, and we wonder why and what's it all about. When I use that phrase, I'm immediately reminded of an old song called What's It All About, Alfie? Is it just for the moment we live? What's it all about, Alfie? And I forget who sang that song. But I think today most people are very confused by what's going on, whether it's the economy, the COVID propaganda that's been going on for years, the war in Ukraine, the politicians, their election, their talk, their constant nonsense, their double talk, their confusing messages, what the media is putting out constantly. And I just think that, people feel like they're nowhere. I in that piece that you referred to, I referred to John Lennon's song, Nowhere Man. He's a real nowhere man living in a nowhere land. And I think that's very apt for today. Lenin was on to it long ago, and he was quite dangerous to the establishment for his anti-war activities and his brilliant songwriting. And of course, he was eliminated, the date of which is coming up shortly. So that's what I was trying to convey in that essay.
Yes, and you've done it very well, I would say. And there's much more going on in this essay than what you just detailed. Lenin, of course, was a threat. A lot of people don't know or forget that he was targeted by COINTELPRO, J. Edgar Hoover's pet project.
Yeah.
Which speaks volumes about how dangerous the powers that ought not be at the time thought he was. This is the same program that targeted Fred Hampton, Martin Luther King, Dr. King. And these people were seen as threats, not just because their message was reaching so many people, but because their message was reaching a very heterogeneous mass of people. It wasn't just reaching, in the case of Fred Hampton, for example, he wasn't just trying to organize blacks. He was trying to organize black people along with working class whites in Appalachia. He was crossing class and race lines and doing so successfully. And the FBI could not have that, understandably, from their point of view, although I'm certainly not sympathizing with their point of view. And they liquidated him for that very reason.
Yes, that's exactly right. And just as Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was eliminated for the very same reasons, his appeal in 1968 was to white people, to black people. He was appealing to the poor. He was against the war. He had three great themes: racial justice, economic justice, and the end to the Vietnam War and all wars. And of course, they went after him. If we go back to John Lennon, he also was this threat, as were many people at the time. Malcolm X as well. Many people don't understand why Malcolm X was eliminated in February of 1965, but it was for the very same reasons, and he had come to an agreement with MLK Jr. That they were going to work together. Most people think of, most white people at least, think of Malcolm as someone who was a black racist against white people. And this is completely to misconstrue where he was at, his spiritual development, and where he was going and what he was hoping to do. And of course, he was being tracked and traced by the same government forces, including the CIA, as he traveled around the world and came home just in time for a very convenient assassination.
Mm. Yes, very true about the modern perception, modern mainstream perception, long held with regard to Malcolm X. He's still very often cast in the light as the words that I believe COINTELPRO used to describe him, a militant black nationalist, which is conflated with a militant black racist and of course, the glaring pejorative there is militant. And I can't help but see a parallel with that sort of characterization, that sort of propagandizing of terms, a parallel from how it was weaponized in that time to what we're experiencing now with the use of terms like MAGA Republican, for example, or this hasn't been used in quite some time, but militias, for example, people who, whether they're organizing into militias or not, consider themselves to be true patriots who see the American government as the rotten, to put it mildly and very briefly, entity that it is. And this is, of course, conflated with questioning official narratives, and that can't happen. So questioning official narratives has been conflated with conspiracy theorizing, the spreading of mis and dis and malinformation, which has been conflated with essentially being a national security threat, if not an international security threat. And I should point out too that what's enabled this progression has been the increasing digitization of our society with ever more new digital technologies to supposedly keep us connected and make life easier and faster. Although, if you look into the provenance of a lot of these projects, that's far from what they're about.
Yes, for sure. I don't think we can emphasize, we cannot overemphasize enough the dangers that are involved in digital technology and the cell phone. I think I've said this many times, probably to you, and I've written about it. I think it's one of the key factors that is involved in this terrible trajectory that has happened, starting in the 60s, but then developing in the 80s, 90s, 2000s to today, where state authorities now control the internet, not totally, obviously. They can snoop on everyone, everywhere, at any time, telephone. Of course, the cell phone is key to this, and they can track everyone whenever they want, or they do all the time, if they wanted to follow you. So they don't have to write a letter to MLK saying, you know, commit suicide because, you know, we're going to get you and we're going to reveal this and that about your sexual life. They can just, you know, give them a little text message. It's all rather easy now.
Yes, yes. You write in your most recent essay, "Today, the spying and propaganda apparatus dwarfs those efforts," the efforts we were referring to, which you just referred to with Dr. King, "exponentially with its electronic digital technology." You follow that up by writing, "but poets don't text the truth. They sing it and think it and tell it even when nobody's listening." And I love that response, that rebuttal to our current situation, really, to our current place in time. And even if people aren't familiar with this essay and the poetry it refers to, one of my favorite poems of all time, by the way, Dulce et Decorum Est by Wilfred Owen, who fought and died in World War One. Even if people aren't familiar with the context, there's so much truth embedded in "But Poets Don't Text the Truth." They sing it and think it and tell it, even when nobody's listening. And one of the truths I derive from that is it comes from thinking about the act of writing, but writing with a pen or pencil and a piece of paper in the analog way, I suppose you could say. And the interiority and intimacy that's involved with that, and how, especially if you are a poet or a fiction writer or even an essayist, how you know nobody's listening and nobody's waiting for your words to be written, but you have this innate, for lack of a better term, drive to put the words on paper, even though there's a good chance they'll never be read by anybody but you.
Yeah.
They'll never change the world, if I can use that grandiose phrase. But it doesn't matter, because the truth is in the act itself, and there's something cathartic, there's something rebellious, there's something, there's a lot to say about individual agency there. And it's hard, as you can tell, for me to put into words, but I think you get what I'm getting at.
Sure I do. And you know, it's imitation is the greatest form of flattery, they say, or someone said, I don't know who it was, but those words that you quoted about, I'll say it and think it and speak it, and if nobody's listening, is of course a nod to Bob Dylan, and which is almost verbatim from his great song, "A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall." And it's interesting to me, very interesting, that when he received the Nobel Prize for Literature, Patti Smith stood in for him, and the song that she sang was "A Hard Rain Is Gonna Fall."
Mm-hmm.
And he obviously, they conferred on that, and he felt it was one of his most important pieces of writing that he's ever done. Which brings me a step further, to mention Dylan again. Next Tuesday, I'm thinking of all these things because I'm writing an essay right now about Leonard Cohen, and Dylan plays a big part in that. And it next Tuesday, and I'm doing another piece on President Kennedy, but Bob Dylan had a song that came out 2 years ago called "Murder Most Foul," which is about the assassination of President Kennedy. And he pulls no punches in that song, none whatsoever. He says the government killed Kennedy, and they did it in public space. They wanted everyone to see it, and that they would be coming for his brothers next.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, Dylan. When commentators, of course, Dylan is a celebrity type, for sure, but when he came out with that song, all they commented on was the pop music references in the song, and they avoided talking about what he actually was saying about the assassination of the president. And so they just skipped over it all. But it's quite powerful.
It makes you wonder, it makes you wonder when that happens, that response happens, if they are these corporate media types, if they are purposely avoiding it, or if they're just so dense that they don't even realize that that's embedded in, so deeply embedded in the song. Probably a mixture of both, but completely unsurprising.
They do it on purpose.
You think so?
I do.
Yes. Yeah. I would agree in this case almost certainly, because Dylan's lyrics are quite, they can be obtuse in ways, but at the same time, very straightforward. And it sounds like from what you, the excerpt you just recited to me, that it's very clear what the message is of the song. So it has to be purposely ignored in this case. And that's a small example of what's happening on such a large scale in so many ways. So for example, the harm and death that the COVID-19 injections are obviously causing around the world, but will not be talked about in corporate media. Corporate media has changed its tune a lot since early 2020, but you can see that it refuses to talk about these injections as a cause of an increase in excess mortality all over the world. And it just wants to focus on the lockdowns because that's permissible and that's the popular thing to talk about. That's what has currency right now. And you can come off as being a critical journalist or a doctor, even. I'm thinking of specific doctors who only toe this line and are still celebrated as part of the freedom movement, for lack of a better term. They won't touch the injections. And it's striking to me that all the ways that the Kennedy phenomenon, if I can put it that way, is still reproducing itself today in other forms. And the harm it's causing is equal. The societal harm it's causing is equal, if not greater, than that caused by the assassinations of John and Bobby.
Yes, those are foundational events. Again, I don't want to repeat myself too often, but I don't think you can repeat it often enough that the killing of President Kennedy by the Central Intelligence Agency and the killing of Malcolm X, the killing of Bobby Kennedy, the killing of Dr. Martin Luther King, all government assassinations, but the killing of the president being the first and the most the most public, obviously. Everyone has seen scenes from that day over and over and over again. And it was a message sent loud and clear. We are in charge. We run the country. We will blow your head off. It's as simple as that. You want to be the president? Okay, you toe the line. And if you don't, you'll get your head blown off. Very simple. Mm-hmm. Here's the message. Look at the film again, keep watching. And every one of these characters who becomes president of the United States knows damn well that this is the way it goes. That's why they still to this day, Trump said he'd, not that I hold great store by the documents that are still being held on the assassination, But, you know, Trump withheld them, said he was going to, open it up and let them out. He didn't. Biden said the same thing. And then last December, he again said no. He said he'd do it in December 21, the JFK documents I'm talking about. And now mm-hmm. he says he'll do it this December. And I think you can be certain that he will not.
Right.
That next December, you know, a few weeks from now will come and pass. And he'll have some cock and bull story about national security, some absurdity. But these assassinations, they keep reverberating down through the years because they're fundamental. They're fundamental to what's going on today. Everything has built upon them. Has mm-hmm. built upon them.
Yes. And that speaks too to this idea that is very much, has been very much pursued since JFK's assassination and shortly afterward, Bobby's assassination. This concept, this realized concept of continuity of government, even though there's a seeming change of the guard every 4 or every 8 years, the apparatus continues as it's always been at its foundation, although it reproduces itself with new tentacles each time. And so that's why you saw not just the same policies Bush carried out under Obama, but the same policies carried out and then some. And this transitioned into Trump, you saw the same policies carried out and then some. I'm thinking particularly with regard to foreign policy. And with Biden, same story. And I have no doubt that, and I'm essentially reiterating what you just said, that those assassinations of John and Bobby were in large part, if not entirely, to set that stage for the perpetual continuity of government. We need to take a quick break, but when we come back, there's plenty more mind I'd like to put to you. So I hope you'll oblige, and I'd love to hear what you have to say in response. So everybody, please hang tight. And I will be right back with Ed Curtin here on TNT Radio after this.
TNT Radio's Lynn Shaw.
Let's face it, we live in a digital world and it's not going away. We live in, actually, I call it a TikTok world. Now that they're the number one platform, they will be going up against Amazon. They're going to create the TikTok shop. So while our kids are spending upwards of 11, 12 hours a day, did you hear that, Warriors? 11, 12 hours a day. I don't know how the kids, they have to go to school, eat, sleep. This is an addiction. And now they're going to have shopping so they can swipe and they can spend money. That is why parents and caregivers, and this is not to blame, all of this is a runaway train that has been going on since the internet hit the ground in 1996. And it's the genie out of the bottle, and it's that runaway train, and the law always lags behind technology. That is why it is important for each and every one of you to know what's going on. Very simple. Sit down with your kids for 5 minutes a day. You got to start somewhere. 5 minutes. All right. We know everybody's busy. This is the number one crime. It must be addressed. Talk to them. What platforms are you on? What apps are you using? Do you talk to strangers? It's got to start somewhere. I can't urge more.
Lynn's Warriors with Lynn Shaw on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Hey, wouldn't it be great if life came with a remote control? You know, you could hit pause when you needed to, or hit rewind, like that time you knocked down that wasp's nest.
Uh-oh.
Or that time you forgot to roll up your windows in the car wash.
Fantastic.
Yeah, a remote control would have come in handy then. Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. With early diagnosis and a few healthy changes like managing your weight, getting active, stopping smoking, and eating healthier, you can stop prediabetes before it leads to type 2 diabetes. It's easy to learn your risk. Take the 1-minute test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Life doesn't come with a remote control.
Yikes!
So you're on your own with the WASPs. You have the power to take control of prediabetes. Visit doihaveprediabetes.org today. That's doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.
News more twisted than soap operas.
Ugh.
And with worse actors.
You can't be serious.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to Perspective here on TNT Radio, where we are live 24/7. I'm Jesse Zerwell, and I'm speaking with writer and sociologist, and I'm going to add philosopher to that, Ed Curtin. Ed, just to jump back quickly to our discussion in the previous segment, and a lot of us feeling as if we're located absolutely nowhere. What I was trying to get at, I realize now, with regard to writing, to sitting with a notebook, and it doesn't just have to be this form of analog creation. It could be painting, it could be photography, even digital photography. But these are not just ways to create and evolve one's thinking, among many other ways of making oneself whole and fortifying oneself, but they're also ways to locate oneself in the nowhere land, I would say. I wonder if you agree with that.
Oh, I sure do. Indeed, in order to locate yourself somewhere, and again, I'm laughing. I think I wrote a line in that essay you're referring to. Everyone has to be somewhere, which is sort of a joke, but obviously true. But in order to the way you describe it, sit there with a pen or a pencil, it also demands a certain silence. And the enjoyment of silence and being alone with your own thoughts, and more than your own thoughts, with the thoughts that will come to you, not just the thoughts that you think, you know, but thoughts that think you, that come out of the blue, so to speak. And this, of course, is the key to creative writing in any form, but it's also the key to a deep life, a spiritual life, however you define spiritual, and to discovering insights about the world and about yourself and about the connection between your inner life and the outer life of the world, which are encapsulated one within the other. And you can't do it without silence and being alone with yourself. But the phone, this allows people who have that damn phone by their side all the time, it takes away from this isolation in the silence. It's always there. Mm-hmm. And so I completely agree with you. I would like to say this too. When you ended the first part of our talk here today, our conversation, you were talking about continuity of government. And if you go back shortly after, President Kennedy and Dr. King, who comes into the U.S. government but Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney? And these guys continue in the U.S. government straight up through the Iraq War, and they move in and out of government and into the military-industrial complex corporations. And then in the 80s, there they are, and there's Oliver North, and there's continuity of government, and so on and so forth, down to the present day, in which neoconservatives exert such a strong power over the administration of President Biden today.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And Peter Dale Scott, the scholar, he has written a great deal about all of this, of course. But I think it's important to see that this has been going on for a long time, and it's been building. And here we are today.
Yes. Yes, indeed. What you mentioned about silence and being alone with one's thoughts, and not just what you are actively thinking, but the thoughts that come to you at the same time. It reminds me, of course, of Keats's notion of negative capability, but yeah. Also probably a bit obscurely for some, what the Scots poet George Mackay Brown referred to as the interrogation of silence. He referred to poetry as the interrogation of silence, and I've always loved that description of what is poetry. I think it's both precise and mysterious at the same time, which is what the best of poetry, in my opinion, is how it's structured. It's precise, but as you said the last time we spoke, it leaves room for what John Berger called enclaves of the beyond.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a great quote. I've heard it, but I forgot who said it. But the interrogation of silence, that's beautiful and very, very, very appropriate.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And I think it's more appropriate now at our present time than ever, as we are bombarded. It's not even day after day anymore. It's or hour after hour, it's minute by minute, if not second by second, with propaganda, of course, but news story after news story, development after development. And as we heard during the break, an excerpt from one of my colleagues' shows, for kids, it's at a point now where all they know is this online space and how time is compressed and sped up in that online space. And it's gotten so bad that it really is important to speak to parents out there through a forum like TNT Radio and say, hey, just take 5 minutes with your kid, start somewhere, and try to, as best you can, rein in this runaway train that digital technology has corralled us into. And again, it's all connected. It's these social media apps, it's the nonstop propaganda blitz that's global in scale, not just confined to the US. And again, I'm riffing here, but I think one of the ways to resist that, if not defeat it, is through the interrogation of silence, through art, through creation, and being able to be alone with oneself, and being able to say to oneself, despite the surfeit of information out there, being okay with saying to oneself, I don't know. I don't know the answer to this. I don't know what's going on. I can speculate. And being comfortable in that in-between unknown space, because everybody nowadays wants to have the answer and put forth their answer. And that is just another component of this madness.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I don't, we agree on that need to do that. And one of the things that I find helpful is, as you probably gather, I love great music, and I have my favorites, obviously. And there is a song by Leonard Cohen. It's called "And the Night Comes On." And it begins like this. I went down to the place where I knew she lay waiting under the ice and the marble and snow. I said, "Mother, I'm frightened of the something and lightning." And so it's really, he goes to the underworld, mm-hmm. really. And the second part of it is about his father, not literally his father, but his father. And in it's a fantastic song, both in its tunefulness and in his language. And it has this mysterious quality. So sometimes I'll listen to a song like that and then just think about the song and think about the lyrics and, you know, not listen to it anymore, but listen to my thoughts listening to the song. Mm-hmm. And if for someone who reads books, they would know that this is straight from the Odyssey and the Aeneid of Homer's Odyssey and Virgil's Aeneid, where in both cases, the hero goes to the underworld. Mm-hmm. And in the case of the Odyssey, Odysseus goes to hug his father and his mother, I should say, and he can't. She's a shadow. She's a shade. And then in the Aeneid, he goes to hug Virgil goes to Aeneas, I should say, goes to hug his father, and the same thing happens. And there is this whole mysterious quality to those stories and to the song, which is really poetry in motion. And in the silence, your mind just whirls and twirls, and you think about all of the meaning of that song and those words and that poetry. And what does it mean? And what does it mean for me? Ed Curtin, this one individual.
Yes.
So, it's all a mysterious process. And you can hear the words of the song, but you can also hear other things coming through, you know, little insights, little thoughts, but only if you're quiet.
Yes. And I keep homing in on this, and you and I keep homing in on this, because again, the point is that this is not just a means, but a fundamental means of both resisting and, I believe, making sense as best as one can of our current location in the world and what's happening and why it's happening. I think that I wholeheartedly believe, in fact, that we have to take these moments of silence, however they may manifest for us, whether creatively or just straight meditatively, to draw back from the incessant malaise or incessant chaos, I should say, malaise and chaos of this global digitized propaganda news analysis, commentary, opinion apparatus that never sleeps, this Leviathan that never sleeps, because while it's useful in a lot of ways, I think it's going to destroy us and has destroyed us in a lot of ways, spiritually, psychologically, and physically, perhaps more than we know. It has a delayed effect, I've tended to find. And we're no use to standing up to resisting and to hopefully defeating, I'm using simplistic terms here, I know, but the powers that ought not be and the anti-humanity they're trying to foist on all of us. In other words, we can't just silo ourselves into the digital news sphere all the time. We have to have other ways of fortifying the information we're encountering and negotiating on a daily basis.
Yes, very true. And I'm listening very intently to your words, and I heard you use a phrase. You used a phrase, homing in. Was that the phrase you
used? Yes.
And so as I listen to you, and I hear that phrase, even though we're having a conversation and people are listening or will be listening to this conversation, it's silent for me, silence here in a way. And I hear that phrase and I think, yes, exactly. There's a pigeon, you know, there are pigeons that do that. And pigeons are amazing animals. And what do? They can fly hundreds and hundreds of miles with messages to people far away, and they always know how to get back home.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, what is home for us? Are we always away, or can we like be home sometimes? Not home in the physical sense, but where is home and what is home? And who's taking a message from here to there and bringing it back to us? It's really interesting when you actually have a conversation and listen to people, rather than trying to rattle off your own thoughts before the other person has a chance to say anything.
That's such a good point. That's such an important point that I think about constantly with regard to how I conduct myself on this program, but also in many other regards in conversation, listening to people, even if I know while they're speaking to me that I fundamentally disagree with them, still listening. That I think that the listening part is essential, but so many of us have gotten to the point where we think we're listening, but we're really just, if I can quote from the movie Fight Club, we're waiting for our turn to speak.
Yeah.
And you know, that speaks to, not to use the word speak too much, but that speaks to what you've written about with regard to the ultra nihilism and ultra narcissism that pervades our culture, certainly the American culture, but many, many other cultures and societies around the world. And of course, again, this has been enabled, this has been encouraged by digitization, by social media, by constantly sharing what one is doing. And we know that this has a psychological effect just on the physiological level with regard to dopamine. And it's a drug. It's a drug of sorts. And the more we engage with it, the more into it we become, and the further away from reality, or what we can discern as best we can reality to be, the further away from that we get. And you, in your most recent essay, cite again Wilfred Owen's poem Dulce et Decorum Est, which is an anti-war poem, among many other things. And when I was reading that essay, I thought too of the poet David Jones, who also fought in World War I and wrote a book, which is really an epic poem called In Parenthesis. And yeah. he has a line in there that reads, "They bright whiten all this sepulcher with powdered chloride of lime. It's a perfectly sanitary war." And I read that again last night, and it struck me as so spot on with regard not to just how we engage with wars that are happening in the world, but the wars on us, on our cultures, on our societies. Everything is, I suppose in this case, the powdered chloride of lime is the digital screen that we're constantly interacting with, and the way that divide sanitizes even the worst of what we come into contact with.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And that's a great poem as well. There are so many great poems that came out of that war. Of course, it was described, I'm trying to think of the guy who wrote the book, a wonderful book about the poems, the poets of World War I. It escapes me at the moment. It's a great book. But it, you know, it's kind of the poet's war, right? And some of that poetry is so profound. I mean, why would anyone, like any child, unless they were being propagandized from a young age, you know, want to die for their country? What is a country exactly? And why would you want to die? Wouldn't you rather live? And, you know, I around here where I live, there are places where people put out like 100 flags on what's called Veterans Day in the USA, November 11th. And I see them and I think, my God, what are these people thinking? They this day is not really a celebration. I don't think it is anyway. Of
no
sacrifices people made. It was like lambs sent to the slaughter, and it keeps promoting war and patriotism. But war and patriotism are not the same thing. Martin Luther King was a patriot, and he was vehemently anti-war, and so many other people. And JFK tried to halt the wars and to make a more peaceful world after he went through some terrible experiences with the CIA and the Pentagon and the world almost ending during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And then he just turned. He had this spiritual turning, as James Douglas writes about in his great book, JFK and the Unspeakable. And it always perplexes me. There's so many like fake warriors sitting on their asses promoting war in different ways. It's just terrible.
Yes, it is. And I think that it's going to continue for quite some time, but we need to realize that we both individually and collectively are armed with the tools to, if not defeat it, to put up a very stiff resistance. And a lot of those tools come from within, from from thinking, from creating, and they might not seem like that. They amount to much in the face of the military industrial biopharmaceutical complex, but they do shift consciousness, and shifting of consciousness is a huge weapon, and something that the powers that ought not be do not want to see happen. They want us locked into rigid binary ways of thinking, and we need to resist that. As you said, with regard to JFK, we need to have that spiritual shift. I think a lot of people have been experiencing that, and we need to continue that. So Ed, thank you as always for joining me and for your stellar insights. Always appreciated.
Thank you, Jesse. It was wonderful talking to you as usual. Bye.
All right. Take care.